Hello, it's Wednesday the 8th of December and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-ho. The daily COVID-19 case count in South Korea has jumped significantly once again, breaking the 7,000 mark for the first time. Meanwhile, authorities have stressed the need to lower the number of critical cases in the next 2 weeks. We'll take a closer look in our news briefing shortly. Washington's announcement of a diplomatic boycott of the Beijing Winter Olympics and its decision to hold a democracy summit without Beijing has added to regional tensions once again. We'll assess the implications, including for South Korea, in our in-depth today. And then coming up on Korea Book Club, we'll be exploring the unique and unconventional writings of Bae Soo-ah. Let's begin Korea 24. South Korea saw the highest number of daily infections to date on Wednesday, topping the 7,000 mark for the first time. Health officials say the next 2 weeks will be critical and that they will particularly work to curb the rising number of patients with severe symptoms, which also hit another record. To give us the latest updates, our KBS World Radio news editor, Ku Hee-jin, joins us on the line now. Hee-jin, hello.
Hello, Jang-ho.
First, let's look at these grim and astonishing numbers. We saw daily infections jump by more than 2,200 from the previous day. And this is now another fresh new record after hitting the last record just on Saturday. So can you break down the figures for us first?
Yes, the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency on Wednesday reported 7,175 new daily infections, the highest since the nation reported its first case back in January 2020. This raises the nation's cumulative count to 489,484. The number of critically ill patients also hit a new high of 840, topping 800 for the first time after staying above 700 for 7 consecutive days. The number of the highly transmissible Omicron infections rose by 2 to 38.
Now, while the government had said that it expected the number of cases to rise after it loosened restrictions last month, officials admitted today that the spike in critical cases in particular have surpassed initial projections. They added it's vital to reduce the number within the next 2 weeks. So what more did they say?
Well, senior health ministry official Son Young-ne said on Wednesday that health authorities are particularly concerned about the rapid rise in both daily and critical cases, with the percentage of symptoms turning severe ranging from 2 to 2.5%, exceeding its earlier projection of 1.6%. Son said the government will continue to secure additional beds to prevent a shortage of medical personnel and facilities, adding that current capacity can accommodate around 10,000 new cases. The official, however, opposed some calls that all medical facilities be opened to treat COVID-19 patients, citing risks from transmission within hospitals. And Son said effects from tougher gathering restrictions introduced this week, coupled with booster shots, will begin to show in 1 or 2 weeks.
Meanwhile, the government is currently advising people infected with the virus but showing lighter symptoms to stay at home for their treatment. And now it will offer additional financial support for these at-home patients as well. Can you give us more details?
Well, according to health authorities on Wednesday, financial aid will be available to people who test positive after being fully vaccinated, in addition to those who have recovered from a previous infection, are unable to get vaccinated for medical reasons, or are under the age of 18. For example, in a four-person household, which currently receives a little over 900,000 won for a 10-day quarantine, will be offered an additional 460,000 won. The measure is aimed at encouraging both vaccination and at-home treatment as daily new cases broke the record today. Quarantine for fully vaccinated family members of COVID-19 patients will also be reduced from 10 to 7 days, as long as they test negative on a PCR test on the 6th or 7th day. Starting January, the government plans to provide oral medication for seniors receiving medical care at home.
Okay, let's turn to our other headlines today. President Moon Jae-in has called for international support for his calls to declare a formal end to the Korean War, saying that it's the first step towards denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula and establishing peace in the region. Can you tell us more?
Well, President Moon said in his remarks in a video message screened at the opening ceremony of the 2021 Seoul UN Peacekeeping Ministerial Forum on Tuesday that South Korea desperately wishes for peace, adding that its people and its government have worked to make the peninsula nuclear-free and to establish permanent peace with backing from the international community. White House Policy Coordinator Kirk Campbell said during a forum held near Washington, D.C. on Tuesday that the U.S. is closely working with South Korea to re-engage North Korea. However, he did not answer questions about declaring a formal end to the Korean War. Moon's determination for the declaration comes amid concerns that an announcement by the U.S. of a diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympic Games in Beijing could hamper his efforts so far.
Well, the road to an end-of-war declaration has many hurdles, it seems, after a group of U.S. Republican lawmakers sent a letter to the National Security Advisor at the White House and other key officials on Tuesday, warning that a unilateral end-of-war declaration without a commitment to denuclearize from North Korea could undermine regional security. Can you tell us more about this letter?
Yes, some 35 Republican lawmakers, led by House Representative Young Kim from California and House Foreign Affairs Committee Ranking Member Michael McCaul, addressed a letter to the Presidential Advisor Jake Sullivan, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and Special Representative to North Korea Sung Kim. Young Kim, a Korean-American congresswoman, and her colleagues said a declaration without the North's commitment for a complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization will destabilize security on the Korean Peninsula, and feared that a premature treaty would provide a basis for the North to demand the withdrawal of U.S. forces and the permanent termination of the allies' annual joint and military exercises. President Moon will attend the virtual summit for democracy to be hosted by U.S. President Joe Biden on Thursday. And pundits are already speculating on the message he will convey regarding China, as Biden summit is likely aimed at keeping Beijing and Moscow in check.
This, of course, is in line with Washington's official announcement of a diplomatic boycott of the upcoming Winter Olympics in Beijing over China's human rights record. And Heejin, some even believe the invitation to the summit itself is tacit pressure on U.S. allies to join moves against China.
Yes, and some allies have already indicated they will follow the U.S. lead. According to Reuters and AFP, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced on Wednesday that his government will not send any officials or politicians to the Games in Beijing in February, though athletes will compete. On Tuesday, New Zealand also announced its decision not to send a government delegation, citing COVID-19 concerns and other safety issues. British daily The Telegraph reported that London was considering a partial diplomatic boycott, while Japan's Sankei Shimbun said Tokyo may send an official from outside the Fumio Kishida gap cabinet. As for South Korea, the presidential office said on Wednesday that the government is not reviewing a diplomatic boycott of the Games for now. However, a senior official who declined to be identified said a decision is pending on whether government officials will indeed attend the Games.
Yes, we'll look closer at the souring of relations between the US and China further and South Korea's position within that for our in-depth today coming up shortly. We'll leave it there for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates today.
Thank you.
US President Joe Biden is set to host a special virtual event this week, bringing together leaders from more than 100 countries, including South Korea. It's called the Summit for Democracy, and the State Department has said it's aimed at tackling threats faced by democracies through collective action. However, notably not invited to the event were China and Russia. The US also announced this week that it will carry out a diplomatic boycott of the Beijing Winter Olympics next February in protest of human rights issues in China. For South Korea, this further breakdown in relations between the US and China is once again leaving it with a lot to consider over how to balance its relations with the two superpowers. To discuss, we're joined on the line now by political science professor Robert Kelly from Busan National University. Welcome back to the show, Professor Kelly.
Thanks for having me.
So let's break it down part by part. How would you first sum up what the Summit for Democracy is for anyone who might not know? And what's the aim for the Biden administration?
Yeah, I think there's been a sort of consensus emerging in Washington in the last 5 to 10 years, perhaps certainly in the last five, that China has taken a pretty serious autocratic turn, that Putin isn't really going anywhere in Russia and is doing more or less sort of a gangster, if you will, right? I mean, he's been trying to bully Ukraine, might invade it next year and things like that. And so I think the Biden people came in and said, you know, we're going to be different than Donald Trump. We're not going to go and talk to these dictatorships. We're going to stand for American values. And that's been an issue in U.S. foreign policy many times in the past. And President Kennedy talked like that. President Carter talked like that. This sort of comes and goes in U.S. foreign policy history. And so I think this is a way for Biden to sort of unite those two sort of schools, right? The kind of growing hawkishness on China and Russia and Washington and a sort of general desire to have a more idealistic or less sort of cynical foreign policy than there was under Trump.
So what do you think we can expect to come out from the summit? Or is this just basically a statement aimed at China and Russia from the U.S.?
Well, it's certainly not going to be very operational, right? I mean, this isn't going to have the kind of institutional depth that NATO has, for example, right? I mean, that's sort of actually been sort of bandied about too, right? We might have like a global NATO or something like that. That would be pretty difficult, right? The democracies under this rubric are culturally pretty diverse. And so I'm not sure how deep the statement can be. It's actually kind of an interesting question, actually, to what extent the United States can actually try to gather a sort of coherent, focused democratic statement on issues like, you know, Muslims in Western China or something like that. I'm actually quite curious to see how far the Biden people can go. But I mean, my sense is that expectations are low. This group has never met before. Like I said, the sort of cultural diversity is pretty wide. You're sort of reaching out to people all over the planet to see if you can find something in common. That'll be pretty tough. So yeah, I think in the end, it'll probably be more read as a statement that the Biden people are going to use sort of ideological differences as a way to push back on Russia and China, just like you said.
Critics might argue that all this will do is antagonize China and Russia and that it won't help lower tensions and it'll just raise tensions.
Yeah. The Chinese and the Russians are going to change because of it. But I think there's, at least in the U.S., I think there is what's sort of a tradition in the United States, I guess, kind of a sort of liberal, idealistic kind of internationalist tradition going all the way back to Woodrow Wilson, that we, the Americans, should sort of stand up and talk about values in our foreign policy, that our foreign policy shouldn't be strictly transactional and strictly sort of cynical and focus solely on a very narrow, materially defined national interest, that the United States should stand for something greater. That kind of discourse really rings in the United States a lot. I mean, I don't hear that very often in Asian democracies. I don't think you hear that very often. But in the United States, this stuff really plays, this idea that the United States should sort of stand for something more than just, you know, sort of capitalism and trade. And I think that's what the Biden people want to do, right? Because we had that under Trump, right? I mean, Trump said things to Xi Jinping, like, it's okay if you throw Muslims in concentration camps. You know, the American public is just not going to swallow that kind of language for long. And I think that's one of the reasons why Biden this idea has been somewhat resonant in the United States, because I think the U.S. foreign policy community would like the U.S. to be, you know, more than just cynical. And if that provokes the Chinese and the Russians, well, you know, too bad, because they're autocracies, so we don't really need their approval.
South Korea was invited, and President Moon has confirmed that he is attending. How do you think China would view South Korea's participation? Would there be significant discontent, or is there enough, perhaps, an understanding in Beijing that Seoul is looking after its own interests with Washington?
That's actually a really good question. My sense at this point is that almost everything South Korea does upsets the Chinese, right? That you guys are sort of like the first place where the Chinese anvil is landing, right? That the Chinese have really sort of decided that South Korea is one of these sort of weak spots in the sort of U.S. architecture in Asia. And they're really sort of pounding away at this, right? I mean, this is sort of like sad all over again to a certain extent, I suppose. I would imagine the Moon people will do what they've done in the past, which is try to walk between the raindrops on this. I mean, they're going to go because, you know, the Americans are like South Korea's security guarantor, right? If the U.S. wasn't here, South Korea's defense budget would like triple or something like that. So, I mean, the South Koreans will probably go, but Moon will downplay it and he won't talk it up. And he'll say some nice things about how we have to reach out to China. I mean, that's what Moon's been doing the whole time. And that's actually one of the big contrasts with, I think, in the presidential election next year, right? If the conservatives take the presidency back, I think you'll see a much more hawkish foreign policy position coming out of China or out of South Korea on China. The South Korean right would love to join this thing and do this much more full-throatedly than Moon, who's going to kind of, I think, waffle about it and, you know, keep one foot in each camp.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, in a further souring of relations between Washington and Beijing, ahead of the summit, the White House announced on Monday that they will be carrying out a diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympic Games in Beijing over China's human rights abuses. This means they will not be sending any diplomatic or official representation to the Games. The White House spokesperson Jen Psaki cited China's alleged genocide and crimes against humanity in Xinjiang and other human rights abuses. In response, China pledged countermeasures, claiming that the U.S., their decision is a serious violation of the principle of political neutrality in sport. First, how significant would you say this boycott is?
Not terribly. We've seen boycotts in the past. They happened during the Cold War. I mean, the biggest sort of impact, quite honestly, is on the athletes, unfortunately, who, you know, train for all these years and then can't get to go. I mean, those sort of voices will show up on TV and people will feel bad for them. But geopolitically, I don't think a whole lot. I mean, I think the Chinese are putting the Americans in a really sort of tough spot with the concentration camps in Western China. I mean, the concentration camps, I mean, looking away on that is pretty awful, right? I mean, I would like to see the U.S. go to the Olympics. I'm not sure it's actually such a great idea. I'd like to see the U.S. keep bridges and doors open to the Chinese. But, I mean, concentration camps, right? I mean, that sounds like, you know, like the Nazis and stuff like that. I mean, the Chinese really need to sort of come around on this. So they're going to find democracies are just going to have a very, very hard time working with them.
Mm. We should clarify that athletes are going, but it's just the diplomats and official representation from the U.S. That won't be going. China has adopted some very stern language in its response. The foreign ministry spokesperson, Zhao Lijian, said, and I quote, "The U.S. will pay a price for its erroneous actions. You may wait and see." That is very strong language. How do you think China will respond?
Yeah, I thought that just sort of strikes me as fairly typical diplomatic bluster. I mean, the Chinese talk like that a lot. I'm not really sure what the Chinese can do to the extent that they need access to U.S. markets for their exports. And because the Chinese hold a great deal of, you know, reserve assets in dollars and treasury bills, I'm not really sure that the Chinese actually want to sort of push the United States in such a way that would actually provoke a major crisis in the U.S. because China and the United States are pretty interwoven. On the other hand, I mean, I suppose what the Chinese might do is sort of continue the process of delinkage, right, which is sort of pull the two economies apart. That would make it easier for China to sort of push back. But I'm not really sure, I mean, like what that would mean. I mean, if the Chinese were to, like, strike a U.S. asset in East Asia, I mean, that could result in, you know, a major crisis. So I'm not really sure. Maybe so China will take something out on, you know, American allies in the region, you know, sort of like Taiwan or something like that. But I don't know. It seems to me sort of extraordinarily, it seems like an extraordinary overreaction to sort of provoke a crisis with the Americans over the Olympics. And it's the kind of thing the Chinese are going to do over Hong Kong or Taiwan, I think.
Let's swing this around again to how it will affect South Korea. This boycott, it's been seen as somewhat of a spanner in the works for Seoul, as it had seemed that the government was hoping to use the Olympics as an opportunity to get all related parties in the same room to restart dialogue with North Korea. make progress on a declaration to formally end the Korean War. It was all the more disappointing as a senior Beijing official, Yang Jiechi, had reportedly backed Seoul's push for an end-of-war declaration last Friday. So does the U.S. boycott effectively end Seoul's chances of making progress towards that declaration at the Beijing Olympics?
I don't think so. I understand the argument, and it would be nice if you could get sort of everybody in the room. I mean, I understand why the Moon people would like this. I think that's really not the big issue on the EOW, the end of war declaration. The real thing concern on the American side is, you know, what does it actually entail? If it's not the current armistice, but it's not a full-blown peace treaty, what exactly is it? I think that's the real sort of issue in the United States, and to what extent does it undercut the position of the United Nations and U.S. forces, Korea, here? That the Chinese want to sign it, they will, if it looks like it in some way sort of advances the cause of stability in North Korea, I think, regardless of whether or not the Americans go to the Olympics. So I'm not really sure about that. I mean, the Moon administration seems to sort of like these big confabs, so I suppose that might be one of the reasons why. And it is sort of important that the U.S. and China keep talking on North Korea. That is one of the reasons why I wish the U.S. wouldn't boycott, because I do actually think that the U.S. and China need to cooperate on North Korea, because it's not going to come around. Pyongyang won't come around unless we sort of work together on that. So, but I don't think I'll undercut the EOW effort.
What do you make of Yang Jiechi's backing of the end-of-war declaration? Do you think China are interested in the declaration?
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that it sort of helps solidify the legitimate existence of North Korea, then yes. I mean, in the United States, North Korea is often seen as sort of like this weird sort of failed experiment of history, right? Sort of like East Germany, and at some point it should sort of go away because the inter-Korean competition has been won by South Korea just as it was won in Germany by West Germany. And so North Korea is kind of like this cul-de-sac. It's this sort of error of history, and at some point it should sort of go away, right? And China, of course, doesn't really want that, right? And Chinese have said for 15 years that North Korea is a buffer between it and the United States, Japan, and South Korea. And so I think the Chinese will like anything that sort of like helps increase the formality, the existential legitimacy of North Korea, and would help it be more stable and feel less threatened. So yeah, I'm not surprised at all that Chinese would support it.
So now that the U.S. has decided to carry out their diplomatic boycott, there is speculation that Washington is seeking allies to join them in their boycott, putting pressure on others. The South Korean presidential office released a statement today saying that it's not considering a diplomatic boycott of the Games for now, but that it also hasn't decided that they will attend, so leaving it a little bit open-ended there. How much pressure do you think Seoul is under from Washington to join the boycott?
Yeah, that's actually a good question. I wonder how really important the Americans think it is for smaller allies to sort of follow this, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, my sense is that, again, that the Americans understand that South Korea is sort of a smaller country living next to China and is sort of stuck. I think that's why the Americans have not really sort of overreacted to a lot of the Moon's efforts to walk between the raindrops so much. I think if the Americans are probably more interested in having sort of the Europeans come along, because the Europeans are more sort of in line with the current U.S. emphasis on human rights and foreign policy. But, you know, for countries like China or for like South Korea and Japan, which are sort of really close to China, my sense is there's a lot more sort of like geopolitical room to give. I mean, my sense is not at all that the Americans are really pushing South Korea hard to sort of like make this sort of like existential choice between South Korea or between the U.S. and China, because we understand that South Korea is in a tough spot. It's a small country living next to a very, very large one. So we should give South Korea some room to move.
Right, so the U.S. assessment will be that South Korea really can't afford to boycott the Games.
Yeah, I think that was the same thing when Park Geun-hye went to the great big World War II sort of Chinese military parade that looked like sort of a celebration of fascism in China, and everybody kind of looked the other way. And she went there because she was soliciting Chinese assistance on North Korea, and the Americans didn't really like it. But, you know, whatever. I mean, we knew why she was doing it. My sense is, we understand that South Korea is in a tough spot. Again, it's sort of it's a shrimp among whales, right, as the expression goes, right? It's sort of stuck living next to China. And so, I think that's why you don't see much American assistance, for example, on pushing South Korea into the Quad. You know, we'd like it, but we're not going to, like, force South Korea into a position where, be looking at any kind of, like, serious, Chinese military, maneuvers or something nearby. I mean, it's just South Korea is just too exposed.
And finally, going back to the Washington and Beijing relationship then, two developments this week, the announcement of the boycott for the Games and also the democracy summit without Beijing. Where do you think this all leaves relationships between the two superpowers?
They're sliding towards a Cold War, to be honest. I think that's what's happening. I don't think we're there yet, but I think there has been, as I said at the beginning, I think there's been a genuine strategic reconsideration of China in the last 4 or 5 years. It began under the Trump administration, particularly when Corona sort of took off and the Chinese sort of obfuscated on that. And it's one of the few things actually where there's a lot of bipartisan consensus now in the United States that China is a strategic competitor, is the language that's usually used now by the White House. But, you know, I mean, there's more hawkish language out there, like calling, you know, an opponent of the United States an enemy and things like that. I mean, the U.S. discussion on China has moved to the right substantially in the last 5 or 6 years. And like I said, I think that's going to be one of the big divisive issues in the South Korean presidential election, because the South Korean left and right are really divided on how to approach China. I think South Korean conservatives much more willing to sort of say that, like, China's also bullying South Korea and we should line up more closely with the Americans. But yeah, I mean, things are getting worse and it's not really clear how they're going to turn around. I think there are a lot of areas for cooperation, like North Korean climate change and stuff, but all that I think is being sort of shut down by the sort of like mano a mano kind of eyeball to eyeball sort of perception that's growing that the U.S. and China are engaged in this big standoff, and that's just going to make everything worse, unfortunately. Sorry, that's really down, really like downer note.
It's true, though.
I know. Pretty grim. Sorry.
Professor, we have to leave it there, but we always appreciate your very frank thoughts on these matters. We've been speaking to Professor Robert Kelly from Pusan National University. Thank you once again for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 10.08 points, or 0.34% on Wednesday, closing the day at 3,001.80. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 9.40 points, or 0.94%, to close at 1,006.04. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 3.61 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,175.91. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's Korea Trending, our daily segment where we round up some of the other news stories that have been attracting attention online today. And for that, we have joining us in the studio, Walter Lee, once again. Walter, hello.
Hello, Jang-ho. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. So what stories have been trending online in Korea then, Walter?
Okay, so we'll discuss how people will be able to buy imported urea water solution online from Wednesday. We'll also talk about a man in his 70s being rescued after being trapped in a bathroom for over 2 weeks. And finally, we'll find out which player of the Korea Baseball Organization is considered one of the most promising international players by a popular baseball statistics site.
Okay, so we start with an issue that we haven't talked about for a while, and that was the urea water solution shortage crisis from a few weeks back that threatened to bring the transportation industry to a standstill. So what's the latest then, Walter?
Okay, so it seems the crisis over the nation's shortage of urea water solution resulting from China's export curbs is virtually coming to an end. Starting from Wednesday, people will be able to buy the diesel exhaust fluid online. Previously, the purchase of the material had only been possible at government-designated gas stations. The Ministry of Economy and Finance said the government held a meeting of related ministries on Tuesday and decided to allow the online sale of imported urea water solution from Wednesday. The government decided to allow such sale after revising an order on the sale of the material, which was issued last month to address the glitches in supply and demand of the fluid. It's worth noting, however, that domestically made solution will still be distributed through designated gas stations only.
Okay, so that is great news to hear that the situation has stabilized enough that the government is reallowing the purchase of the substance online. However, we aren't quite out of the woods yet, as I understand that there is some limit on the amount of imported solution that can be bought online.
Yeah, that's correct, actually. Only one person can buy up to 20 litres in 1 day.
I see, so not a huge amount, but should be more than enough each day. I believe some 20 litres will cover a diesel truck for around 800 kilometres, but I think that can vary quite a bit. So looking at the bigger picture then, how much imported urea water solution does the nation have on hand at the moment?
Well, according to the Environment Ministry, local importers currently have about 6.9 million litres in stock. An additional 7 million litres is scheduled to be imported this month. I'd like to add that the government also plans to allow the sale of the imported material through other channels, including in retailers. It also plans to keep a close eye on the amount of imported urea water solutions distributed along and crack down on firms that illegally distribute the material.
Okay, so the crisis, it seems, is almost over. But, of course, there's still work for the government to make sure to build safeguards so this doesn't happen again. Okay, moving on, what else do you have for us today, Walter?
Okay, so our next story is about a 77-year-old man being rescued 15 days after being trapped in his own bathroom. Police in Iksan North Jhola Province on Tuesday morning received a report from the man's friend that they hadn't been able to reach him for some 20 days. Police officers and firefighters immediately headed to the man's apartment where he lives alone and found him on the floor of his bathroom inside the master bedroom. They had to pry open the bathroom door because it was locked. The man, though he wasn't moving, was found to be breathing normally. The man was immediately transported to the hospital and reportedly did not suffer any life-threatening conditions, and he's expected to be discharged soon.
Wow, well, first, thank God he's okay.
Right.
How was he able to survive for 15 days? That's half a month trapped in the bathroom.
Right, well, police found that the man collapsed after going into the bathroom for a bath 15 days ago. He apparently was trapped there after not having enough strength to open the door by himself. He wasn't able to contact anyone because his phone was outside on his bed. And according to the police, the man had endured the 15 days by drinking water from the bathroom sink with what little strength he had left. Fortunately, the bathroom wasn't too cold because the heating system was running in the house.
Right, so the next question I'm sure that's on everyone's mind is, how did the man end up in this situation? You would think that bathrooms can be unlocked from the inside, no?
Right, so according to the police, the door didn't have a knob or a latch at the time. They suspect it broke somehow and the man just left it unfixed, hence his inability to let himself out.
Right, so the door got wedged somehow and he just couldn't find a way to open it or even break it open. Thank God the friend called the authorities and that he was found safe and sound in the end. Okay, let's move on to our final trending story now. What are we looking at?
Yes, so a US-based major and minor league statistics site has highlighted the strengths and potential of the KBO's Yi Chong-hu, outfielder of the Kyum Heroes. Fangraphs.com unveiled on Tuesday an updated list of 70 promising players from the countries around the world, including South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Cuba, and Venezuela. The list gave each player a grade called Future Value on a scale of 20 to 80. He received the second highest grade of 50 among the players on the list, just 5 points behind Japan's Yoshinobu Yamamoto on the Nippon Professionals Baseball's Oryx Buffaloes.
Right, I understand that this site, for the most part, is no-nonsense when it comes to baseball data analysis and projections. So for E to receive such a score, it cannot have been just based on opinion alone. What were some of the reasons given by the site that helped him land the number two spot?
Well, citing that E is the son of baseball superstar Yi Chong-bom, the site said the 23-year-old E has had more walks than strikeouts in the past 2 years while doing a great job defense-wise in the right field. It also added that, quote-unquote, he also wields one of the sweetest-looking swings on the planet. The site went on to say that E's size may limit his power, but his bat-to-ball skill has huge potential. And as someone who began his pro career at such a young age, he is on track to hit MLB free agency at 24.
Wow, so according to this site, he should be well on his way to the majors and soon as well. There were other Korean players that made this list as well, right?
Yes, there were. So, in fact, 7 other KBO players made the list, including fellow teammate An Woo-jin, as well as Kang Baek-ho of the KT Wiz, just to name a couple.
Okay, that's where we leave it for Korea Trending today. Thank you for those stories, Walter, and we'll see you on Friday.
See you next time.
It's time now to delve into the world of Korean literature once again for our weekly Wednesday segment, Korea Book Club. With me now in the studio is our literary critic, Barry Welsh, to introduce another Korean book in translation for us. Barry, hello. It's good to see you again.
Yes, good evening, Jang-ho.
Okay, so what do you have for us today?
So this evening we're reviewing a short story called Time in Grey, or Huisek Shi, by Bae Soo-ah, and it was first published as part of the Asia Publishers Modern Korean Literature series in 2017, and it was translated by Chang Chong-hwa and Andrew James Keast, who also translated Park Song-won's excellent What Makes a City, or Doshinun Muosoro Iruochinunga. We reviewed that a few weeks ago. And Bae Soo-ah actually made her debut back in 93. And since then, she's been very prolific, writer of novels and short story collections. And some of her notable works include Recitation and, I think, most recently, Untold Night and Day. And she has a very loyal fan base, and many people are passionate about her work. She also has several works available in translation. And when I realized we hadn't reviewed anything by her, I thought we should rectify this, because she's a very distinctive writer with a unique style and approach. And she's celebrated for having this very unconventional style of writing.
Okay, so what do you mean by that? What do you mean by unconventional? And mm-hmm. do we see this unconventional approach in this book, Time in Grey?
Right, yes, we definitely do. So Time in Grey is split into three sections. The first section is kind of an essay, which frames the short story which we get in the second and third sections. So you have to read this essay to sort of appreciate and unpick the story that follows. In the first essay section, so Bae is reflecting on time and memories and our dreams and fantasies of the future. And she writes that we have this blending of our future expectations with memories of past events, and that the relationship between future and past is interconnected in our minds. She says that our memories of past events are hints of someday in the future drawn out by our thoughts, our own unconscious wishes. And then she goes on to say that perhaps the past is more unknowable than the future, even though we've been through it. Mm. And this seems to echo this, you know, famous saying from L.P. Hartley, the past is a foreign country, they do things differently there. She says, Bae writes in this essay, as time goes by, the scenes of the past become more foreign and more dubious. And those impending events will feel closer and also more approachable, bringing with them profound stories not obscure to us. So for Bae, the past becomes this grey space. She talks about it as the sort of grey space that you're looking through. And we view the past through these kind of shades of grey. And the future is more real and tangible for us.
Okay, I understand that Bae in this essay gives an example of sorts of the type of memories that might arise in our minds and influence our future or present selves.
Right. So the essay, she starts off with these, talking about this relationship between the past and future memories. And then it kind of jumps into this the section where she talks about a friend who's a vegetarian, and her friend is filled with guilt over their previous consumption of meat, and these memories of previously eating meat often arise in their mind and make them feel guilty. And this anecdote is used to highlight what Bae sees or argues in this essay is the central role of guilt in bringing past memories sort of randomly into our minds. They just sort of randomly come into our consciousness in the present because of this guilty association. And then it's these sort of random occurrences that have this profound influence on the futures that we pick out or try to follow. Honestly, the section, it's quite dense and it's occasionally tricky to follow, but it does have an intriguing concept.
Right, so taking this theory of memories, guilt and future dreams then, how does that then take us to the story in the next section of the book?
Right, so the next section is the most sort of substantial section of the book, and it's the most typically story-like section. It's a So a story, the narrator tells a story about their own life, and it features events in their past, their present, and then a sort of potential, the future. Incidentally, the narrator could be male or female. It's sort of left ambiguous. I actually assumed a female narrator, but I've saw other reviewers and people online who assumed otherwise, assumed it was a male narrator. But regardless, it's sort of left ambiguous. So make of that what you will. But anyway, the narrator tells us they were infatuated with a young woman called Sumi like 20 years previously. This unnamed narrator loved Sumi, loved this person from a distance, and often dreamed of being together with them. However, Sumi had a boyfriend at the time, and our narrator was too reticent to declare any feelings. Then in the present of the story, or what we might think of as the narrator's present, or recent present, the narrator unexpectedly bumps into Sumi again after this period of 2 decades separation. So they're both older, they've changed, and Sumi reveals that she knew at the time how the narrator felt about her all those years ago and didn't act on it either. And then the narrator comes to realise how insubstantial and meaningless her past memories of Sumi are, the sort of the idealised memories she had of this person. The narrator says, yes, that is what the true feelings of a human being are, mere rumours. And for the sake of mere rumours, truth is not necessary. Were I to make some explanation in order to justify myself, it would become just another piece of the great rumour that makes up all of reality, vanishing immediately into that place where it could never be apprehended.
Okay, so it's quite a conventional setup, but then the conclusive train of thought is quite unconventional, going back to our musings on time and memories. So you said there was a third section as well. How does that final section develop these ideas, and what conclusion does Bear reach there?
Right, so that this final section should be bringing the, you know, the story together, and then, you know, with the ideas that were sort of explained or outlined in the essay. And it's sort of possibly set in an imagined future where the narrator and the narrator's vegetarian friend from the essay at the beginning and Sumi are together, and you know, this is some imagined future where they're friends. Perhaps the narrator and Sumi are together romantically or in a relationship of some sort, and here the narrator ponders that, you know, what we feel floating in our memory now are phantoms, or our expressions remember ourselves and shadows remember us, as we do in the present. And the story ends there on this very ambiguous note, with this trio of people about to enjoy a meal together.
I see. So it sounds like a very abstract story. What are readers then to make of these reflections on time and memories then, Barry?
Right. So certainly for me, this was not an altogether satisfying story. It's very oblique and ambiguous and difficult to grasp. And even after trying to engage with it, I was left thinking, well, so what? I'm not really sure this amounts to anything particularly insightful. And the method of saying it isn't particularly memorable or engaging. Beisua is, like I said, she's, you know, celebrated for being unconventional and praised for, you know, becoming increasingly unconventional over her career. But this story's sort of, you know, ambiguous elements or unconventional elements didn't really amount to all that much for me. I suspect that, you know, there are lots of readers who would probably have the same response and feel that this is kind of a distant or off-putting work. It frequently seemed to me like a collection of rather random and sometimes even just arbitrary elements in service of a point that not worth making, perhaps, and ultimately a bit of a disappointment.
Right, I see. That's quite a negative assessment. It seems like it didn't really work for you. I understand that this book is one of perhaps Bear's lesser-known works, but as you said, she's quite a celebrated writer, not just in Korea, in fact. She has quite a few works that have been translated into English. In fact, several translated by Deborah Smith, who, of course, famously translated the Man Booker Prize winner, The Vegetarian. So have you read her other works? And is this indicative of her other works as well. And what do you think people do get out of her works?
Right, so I've read a couple of her other novels and one of the other short stories. I read Recitation and I read A Greater Music, and they're, you know, both more sort of substantial works, but they're very much in this kind of similar vein of, you know, memories and contemplation and reflections. And, you know, not like typical narratives with characters and so on. And, you know, I felt they were sort of distancing works. There wasn't something that I found terribly captivating or engaging. But I do know people who are, you know, big fans of her and really look forward to like her new work getting translated and so on. But really, I have to say, it doesn't work for me. What she's doing or the... You know, the style that she's going for, her approach, I don't think it really works for me. You know, those other two novels, again, I just felt reading them, they were sort of keeping you at a distance in a way.
So it didn't quite work for you, but as you said, there are many followers who do like her work. So it sounds like quite a divisive work, a very non-linear and very, shall we say, a Marmite style of work.
Right. Whether
if you love it, you love it. If you don't, maybe it's not for you.
Yeah.
It sounds very intriguing. It's called, it's called Time in Grey, Huezekshi by Pessoa. That's it for Korea Book Club this week. Barry, as always, thank you for coming in and we'll see you again next time.
Okay, take care.
This is Swiss flutist Philipp Jund. I am professor of flute at Neuchâtel Conservatory in Switzerland and at Gangnam University in Korea. You are listening to Korea 24.
We finish up with our closing segment, Morning Edition Preview, looking at some interesting features reports are coming out in tomorrow's English language newspapers here in Korea. And for that, we have our staff editor, Mark Wilson-Chair, joining us in the studio. Mark, hello. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Okay, so where are we headed to first?
We head to the national section of tomorrow's Korea Times. Lee Hae-in writes about a particular bar in Busan causing a bit of a stir after the owner put up a notice that read, translated in the Times, "No professor zone. For the convenience of other visitors, we ask the regular professors of Busan National University to refrain from entering our bar. In case of entry, please do not disclose your profession voluntarily nor loudly."
Wow, so a no professor zone. There is obviously a backstory here then. Why did the bar owner feel the need to put up the sign?
Well, the owner said in a local interview that the rudest customers were indeed university professors and argued that the notice was in response to such behavior, bragging, being loud, being rude, rather than a profession. Of course, this is the owner's account. The owner went on to say that their customers, many of whom are graduate students who are stressed as it is, he doesn't want to risk having them run into the professors at the bar. And though the bar doesn't actually verify nor restrict entry of a professor, some do indeed see it as discrimination, period. Even as an extension of discrimination against certain groups, like children, minors, and older people. Now, East Peace doesn't get into any legal ramifications. Perhaps it hasn't gotten to that point yet. But you can read more about how the public feels, both for, some are very for, and against in tomorrow's Times.
Right, I can understand how it could be seen as discrimination, but I just see it as a sign the bar owner got sick and tired of rude customers who all happen to be professors from Busan National University. Hopefully not our guest earlier for in-depth, Professor Robert Kelly.
Right.
But yes, this bar owner, he's just venting his anger.
You have to bring him on, yeah.
Sure,
yeah.
He's basically asking them to leave their arrogance and bad behaviour at the door, which I think is fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's move on to our second story now. What do you have for us?
We're headed to the culture section of the Korea Herald. Park Yina gives us a glimpse of how the Omicron COVID-19 variant is affecting the local art scene, namely stopping international artists from attending their own shows and exhibitions here in South Korea. It's the mandatory 10-day quarantine, writes Park, that is the biggest wrench being thrown into the artists' and venues' plans.
Right, not only does the 10-day quarantine mean taking a lot of time out of their schedule, there's also the cost involved as well, as they have to pay for their quarantine accommodation for that time. So then, which shows have been affected?
Chinese artist Ai Weiwei won't be able to attend his first large-scale solo exhibition in South Korea. But at this point, people can still enjoy it. It's scheduled to open on December 11th at the National Museum of Modern and Contemporary Art, Korea, or the MMCA. Spanish photographer Yoshigo also won't be able to visit for his planned artist talk and autograph event. His exhibition, Photographs by Yoshigo, Holiday Memories, at Ground Sisal Sochon, was considered one of the hottest shows this year. So fans really expressed their frustrations online. But although the show just finished this past Sunday, its massive popularity, it may help convince him to come visit in the future.
Right, so at least art shows can and have gone ahead because works can be displayed without the artists themselves. Mm-hmm. But other events in the arts have been cancelled entirely, such as concerts and music acts, because obviously without the talent, it can't go ahead. So yes, sad times once again due to the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to end on that down note, but we're out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there. Mark, thank you for those stories, and we'll see you again next time.
Talk to you then.
And that's all we have time for on today's Career 24. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so do join us again then to continue to get the latest news, views and reviews from Korea. Till then, we hope you have a great day. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye.